Okay.
Let me just start by saying that my name is Connor Sorensen, and I'm here with Robert Martin Sr. in his home in Juneau, Alaska, and this is April the 3rd, I believe. Is that the correct date?
Right.
April the 3rd, 1986. And we'd like to talk this morning, Robert, about some things that happened 50 years ago, approximately, mm-hmm. back in the 1930s. The topic of the project we've been working on is Alaskan Native participation in the CCC. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about yourself and where you were born, where you grew up, something mm-hmm. that takes us up to the 30s and the Three Seas days.
Okay, I was born in Sitka to Matilda Plotnikov in Sitka. And in 1915, in October, she moved over here with me and my older sister. And I grew up, and my older sister went to live with someone else, one of my aunts. And I went with my parents after my mother married Bill Martin. In 1921, we went up to Yakutat and then on to Cordova, where he worked at Kennecott Copper, first on a railroad and then in the copper mines itself in Kennecott. And in 1921, when prejudice was prevalent against the Indians, my mother had quite a time getting me into school there, because as first grader, I had to start that year. As it was, I was a trifle late, because in 1921, I was already 7 years old. And she got me in. I don't know what she said to the superintendent of schools, but she finally got me in. I was the only Indian child going to this Cordova Territorial Schools. But in October, we moved back to Juneau, and I, of course, entered the Juneau Bureau of Education School. My teacher's name was Helen Bernhofer, and she taught me until I went to finish the eighth grade. We moved from a shell-like building and behind what used to be the government hospital into what later became the Teenage Club, and is now the site of the Ok Tribe Council building in the village. I entered Juneau High School in 1928, and the same year I joined the Alaska Native Brotherhood, Camp Number 2 in Juneau. The way I got in was, I used to go with my father to the meetings, and the president didn't have a secretary, because the secretary had left. And so he asked me if I could take the minutes, and I said, well, I could try. I said, I've done it in grade school. So he said, well, I'll help you. And after being very fair at taking minutes and being there every meeting, they decided that I should become a member. And so I was sworn in as a member of the Alaska Native Brotherhood in the local camp. And the president at the time was one of the founders of the Alaska Native Brotherhood, Frank Mercer. And from then, I decided that the goals and achievements to the time of the Alaska Native Brotherhood was such that I could be of some help. Even in my young age, I felt that I could be doing something for my people. When during high school I played basketball and tried to get on a team and finally made it 1 year in my junior year, and then just before a tournament in Haynes, I was left at home, and the senior of non-Indian was put in my place. I felt bad for the young fellow, because when he came back, he had a bad knee that he could never take part in athletics again. But that same year, 1931, I quit school and stayed out of school until 1937, when I went back to Sheldon Jackson and asked Mr. Yaw if I would come back and finish, get my high school diploma so I could get away from using a pick and shovel. And so, and it was during this time, when, between 31 and 37, that I ran into this problem with the three C's. Walter Soboleff and Gibson and I went to the Forest Service and asked to be enrolled in the Civilian Conservation Corps. And they put us through all the filling out applications and then physicals. And when we were all through with that, we were told to come back. And when we did come back, we were told that they weren't hiring natives, that a bureau or somebody was taking. And at the time, there was no Bureau of Indian Affairs as such. It was under the Board of Education that the Indians were taken care of. And Charles W. Hawksworth was the superintendent, and he had all the teachers under him in Alaska. And I forget the other man that came from the South every year to check on the schools. And so on. I never finished high school in Juneau, but I went back to Sheldon Jackson and finished in 1939. About 2 months before I graduated from Sheldon Jackson, I discovered I didn't need to go for 2 years at all. I could have finished in 1 year, but that's neither here nor there. And from then on, I still kept going, working with the Alaska Native Brotherhood, and I've served as officers in both local camps and in the Grand Camp. And finally ending up as Grand President, and after completing 2 terms, I became a member of the Executive Committee, which is, excuse me, which is a lifetime affair. Is there any questions? I'm glad to answer.
Sure. could you say, tell me a little bit more about this incident with Walter Soboleff and Gibson Young and yourself? That was in Sitka, I understand.
Yes, it was in Sitka. I used to go there every summer looking for work.
And this was 1934?
Yes. Mm-hmm. 33 or 34, mm-hmm. I'm not too sure now. Walter may remember exact dates, but it was in the early 30s. And I watched the fellas leaving on the Ranger, I forget, 6 or 7. They used to have boats, Forest Service had boats called the Rangers, numbered, and all those young fellas from Sitka going out with, and among them was Bill Hollywood, who was as much Indian as I was, but he never lived in the village, and to all intents and purposes, he was one of those that had given up their Indian heritage. Bill is still alive today, I believe he lives in Ketchikan.
Did you expect to be hired?
Well, when they put us through all those things, we figured they sure would take us, because we were free. We had nothing, no strings to hold us in town, because the work was out on in the Forest Service, in the Forest Monument, or whatever you call it. And they were cleaning trails and building new ones. And so they were out of town all the time, and we had nothing to hold us in Sitka, so we felt certain we would have been hired. And we were clean. And
did you know anything about Forest Service hiring practices at that time?
No, I didn't. It was a surprise to me when they told us that the Indian Service would take care of us. And You know, strangely enough, when I'd come back in the winter in Juneau, I never did go to work for the CWA or whatever they called it. Yeah, I guess it was CWA. Or any
CWA at first, and then it was the CCC.
Yeah. And I never did work for either one. But when I went back and finished high school, I went to work for 3C's that was doing a lot of work on totem poles and then that seawall between the coal storage and the federal building, which is all handwork, by the way, done by Indians. And the totem pole, of course.
This is in Sitka.
Yes. That was in 38, 39, 40. And in 1940, in early spring, our foreman got a job with the contractors on Japonski Island. And he took many of us with him that he could depend on to work with him. We were building a corduroy road up Cascade Creek so that they could haul supplies to build a new dam up there, a water dam. And from there we went. When that was finished, and he left that service, and we went with other foremen. I ended up being a truck driver, a flatbed truck driver on Japonski Island with Nick Cassican. We're the only two Indians driving trucks, by the way, on that island. Even there, the unions were discriminating against us. Couldn't even join the union it's not a full member, but one that pays so much a month just for the privilege of working. So Nick did finally get in as a truck driver in the Teamsters Union. You know, strange Teamsters or...
Who is this Nick?
Cassican. His sister is Esther Littlefield, who still lives in Sitka.
So you were told that the Indian service was taking care of Indian employment?
That they were going to take care of us. They felt that they were going to find work for us. Or that's what they told us, that they were going to find work for us. But we never did. I went to work for the coal storage and got by that way. And then later at the cannery when the salmon seining season opened. Well, I never was without a job. I didn't really have to worry. I made more money than the 3C gang did, but... It was, you know, you feel pretty bad when you do something like that to you.
One time you told me about the different agencies, the federal agencies especially, in their hiring practices, like the Bureau of Fisheries. Remember you talked about that, the Forest Service, the Indian Service. Could you say something about your impression of each one of those and what their attitude was toward Indian hiring?
I went to work for the Federal Service as postmaster in Cake, I used to notice that there was Indians, but they were usually close to the doors, so that if you entered the door, you'd see an Indian sitting there, making you think that there was other Indians in the building. We call it window dressing later on when we discovered the truth. And we had to, of course, in federal service, you have to pass a test in order to get a job. And even then, that didn't guarantee you a job. So maybe two or three others on the register that's higher than you are, and they were the ones that got the jobs. I got the job of postmaster in Cake by political means. And Bob Bartlett happened to know me from my work with Alaska Native Brotherhood. And when my name went in, he threw this previous person's name and put mine in, and I got the job. It's pure and simple.
What about the Bureau of Fisheries, the Federal Bureau of Fisheries?
The Federal Bureau of Fisheries, as far as I know, never hired any Indians. And the only Indian that ever worked was a guide who was a son or grandson to the Richard Harris that came with Joe Juneau. His name was John Harris, John Harris Sr. And that's the only time, and that was only for short periods. In fact, the strange thing, he put the Bureau of Fishery boat on a shoal in Young Bay I guess maybe that's why they didn't hire him again. And the Bureau of Indian Affairs, even if you went into the, after they came full force to Juneau, you go in there and in different departments you'd find a few Indians, but maybe one or two more window dressing. Until it, of course, excuse me, all this time the A and B had been working on this and trying to integrate the Indians into the working employment picture of Juneau and the federal government. I don't know why it was, but I tried several times to get into the Bureau under the Employment Assistance Program, but I never did make it. The only way I got in with the Bureau after I moved here in 1959 was I passed my civil service exam in accounting of some sort, not fully full accounting, but accounting clerk test. So I got in as a payroll clerk, and from there I worked my way up to finally becoming an enrollment officer because of my knowledge of the people in Alaska, and especially in Southeast, to work on the Tlingit Haida enrollment, which was done in the old way that the Bureau does it, under regulations and everything else, where everybody had to have proof of birth, certificate or baptismal record, or an affidavit signed by someone that knew the parents, and that the child was born to them. So I stayed with that job. In fact, I worked for the Bureau for over 20 years. Worked for the post office for 13 and a half years. So I had 33 years in federal service. And I worked for the state government for 3 years in the Fish and Game Department.
Mm-hmm. back to that 1934 incident when you and Sobeloff and Young were not hired. Was that taken up by the A and B as in sort of a test case?
I don't know whether it might have been ours, because Gibson Young's father is Ralph Young, who was one of the organizers of the Alaska Native Brotherhood. And I think he may be the one that took it before the A&B and told them what happened. And then at the convention, I know that there was a motion passed to look into this and find out more about it, and the Grand President was empowered to do all this, and being Sir, I think it was Cyril Zuboff at the time, and he did carry it until he finally got some answers.
Did you know about a similar incident down around Ketchikan?
No, I didn't.
That something like that happened about the same time, mm-hmm, in Ketchikan, but you hadn't.
No, I hadn't heard about that. Mm-hmm. Of course, communications, such as it was in those days, you don't find out things like you do today.
Could you tell me something about the important people in the A and B and also in the federal agencies that were doing hiring in those days? For instance, you mentioned Cyril Zuboff.
Mm-hmm.
That name comes to mind. Don Miller.
Yes,
Frank Booth.
C. Don Miller and Frank Booth. C. Don Miller was a grand treasurer for many years. He was out of Wrangell, but he actually wasn't an Indian. He was a minority, but I'm not sure exactly what he was. But Ralph Young Sr. in Sitka, and Frank Price Sr., and who was there? Louis Shotridge's Grand President, and Cyril Zuboff, Andrew Hope. Paul Liberty had passed on, so he was gone. He's one of the organizers. And here in Juneau, we had Seward Coons and Frank Mercer, and let's see, James Watson, who passed on real early in the late 20s. And then in Cloaca was James C. Johnson, who was one of the organizers and lived until almost the 50s, I think. And in Wrangell was Chester Worthington, who was one of the organizers and one of the outspoken ones. Frank Desmond, for one, who had a son, Livingston, was one of the great athletes of Indian origin. And of course, Sandy Stevens is Grand Secretary. He was from Douglas, and he has some children still living in Juneau. And of course, Walter Sobolev, when I in the 29-30s, was a member of the A&B. In fact, I think he was Grand Secretary at one time in those years. And
could you describe the goals of the A&B at that time?
Well, in the excuse me, in the early 20s, the Alaska Native Brotherhood's greatest purpose was getting education for the children and anyone that wanted to learn. And from that time on, when they won their first case in Ketchikan, the I forget the young man's name was in that. His sister was in that. But anyway, A&B accomplished many things that are beneficial to the natives, and as well as the whites. We fought the fish trap. That was another big thing in those early days. And we didn't do anything about fish traps as a territory or as a state until we became a state. We gained recognitions for native rights as citizens. That was in the 20s. And won the right for natives to vote. That was in the 20s. And integrated public schools. That didn't happen until in the 30s. And extended workman's compensation laws to cover everyone, not just. And included natives in aid to dependent children. Secured direct relief for aged natives. And that was a joke in a way, because I remember cashing a check for an old man that lived across the street from where I had the post office in Cake. He was getting all of $20 a month and expected to live on it. And brought the Indian Reorganization Act to Alaska, and then brought hospitals for natives to Alaska, now under the U.S. Public Health Service, now contracted in Edgecombe is contracted to search, and so is the Juneau Clinic. And got equal rights law, which I suppose you read about.
I did. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And still an item mm-hmm. paper.
Yeah. Then they initiated the Tlingit-Haida land suit in 1929 at the Haines Convention.
Mm-hmm. How do you see employment issues as fitting into these other goals?
Well, they came up in every convention until it was in resolution form, directed to the delegate in Congress before it became a state, and then to the governor and his staff, and to the legislature. We did everything by law, if at all possible. We never used sit-down strikes or anything like that to gain our ends. We always went by law and never by force. That was the exciting thing about the A&B's way of doing things. I remember one incident from a convention. The Juneau Empire would never print anything about the convention being held here in Juneau in 1933. And Louis Paul, who was William Paul's brother, came up with a resolution. He did it. Because the empire wouldn't print anything. But this one resolution was to sell the panhandle of Alaska to the Canadian government. And that, of course, hit the papers finally. And today I see the new Juno Empire building has Indian art on its building. That's quite a changeover. They still don't print too much about us.
What about some of the politicians during the 30s? For instance, you mentioned the delegate, Anthony Diamond.
Mm-hmm.
What was...
It was Wickersham and then Diamond. Mm-hmm.
And how do you see him as...
Anthony Diamond was really a big help to us in Congress, although he was a non-voting representative from Alaska. Yet he did a lot to help the Indian people, especially through the ANB. At the time, the ANB was the only organization. In fact, it's the oldest Indian organization that still runs in the United States. And after Anthony Diamond came Bob Bartlett, who, of course, everyone knows is a fair man and always tried his best to help the people.
How do you account for Anthony Diamond's attitude on it?
Politics. We gave him the votes and he got in. And we controlled the Indian vote in those days. Today, Stevens doesn't even attend our conventions. He goes to AFN. Young doesn't attend our convention, neither does Murkowski. And one of these days, we're going to wake up to the fact that they're not doing anything for us. And then they're going to lose a big block of votes. It's not a threat. It just happens.
What about Governor Choi?
Governor Troy was anti-Indian from the word go. Always had been, I guess, until his death. We couldn't go to him for anything.
Ernest Greening?
Greening was a big help to the Indians. He helped push the Equal Rights Amendment with us. He helped Roy and Elizabeth, like Vern mentioned. Took him along, tells a story about how he asked him about the Equal Rights Bill, and Governor Greening talked to him and talked to him and talked to him, and Byrne didn't get a word in edgewise, which is hard to believe, but that until he was finished. Well, I guess it's being from a people that's discriminated against too, I guess there's a reason why Greening. Well, you know what Green's nationality is. I mean, what he was born.
No, I don't.
Well, I heard that he was Jewish, so, or Hebrew. They're always discriminated against him.
There was a...
But he was a professor, wasn't he?
I don't know much about his early background.
I think he was.
Before he came to Alaska.
And in law, too, I guess.
When I talked with Judson Brown, he mentioned Mayor Goldstein, who was also Jewish.
Isidore Goldstein, yeah.
And who was sympathetic to Native issues.
He was. He could talk Tlingit language as fluently as I can, almost. And his sister is Annabelle Simpson. And that was just a reverse. And yet, Annabelle Simpson's son, Robert, was my classmate in high school, and he was a big help to me at all times. There was four of us that traveled together, Bob Simpson, Bob McLean, Bob Henning, and myself. And one time we were in the Imperial, and somebody yelled, "Hey, Bob," and we all turned at the same time. So, it's strange. The people in my own peer group, you know, these people are high up. They're children of business people, and they got along swell with me. I mean, I got along swell with them. But my own peer group, where my dad made a lot more money than some of those children that I went to high school with. I mean, their parents, and yet we were Siwashes. That's what they called us. I don't know what the word means. I never did like it. I don't even use it today if I can get away with it. So,
Haven't said anything really about the Depression. Do you have memories of what the Depression was and what it meant to you?
Depression forced us to go back and live off our subsistence. My dad and his brothers would go out and get the fish and meat, and my mother and sisters would cure it, smoke it, or salt it, whichever. The salmon was always smoked, it keeps that way. And then my dad and I, we cut cordwood, which was under Bob Lesher. He was a captain in the Salvation Army for a while, and then he took his leave of absence. He paid us $5 a cord for 3 ricks of wood. Had to be sawed up, chopped up, and piled in regular 3-rick cords.
Was that in Juneau?
It was right here in Juneau. Flour we got from, I guess, Department of Agriculture was the one I was dishing out the flour. And since we had, well, I had 5 living sisters and myself, and my sister was in a, it's already, she got married in, yeah, she was already married in the early 30s, and she had several girls and a boy herself, so. But that's how we kept going. I worked in a restaurant in the early 30s, washing dishes for 12 and a half a week, plus all I could eat. I tried not to make it any harder for my parents. So, and I was willing to do that, so after doing that for a few months, I finally got promoted to a day shift and made $15 a week. And that's why I'd always make enough money to get over to Sitka, because my aunt and my uncle, William Peters and his wife, had adopted me as one of their sons after they lost their son, Joe. And so I had a home over there that I could go to and live there and work from their house. Of course, I helped with whatever I could earn, and chopping wood, which I think was what made me so healthy. That was my chore wherever I went. That's my impression. We never, as a family, had it very hard, because my dad was always able to get a job, and he made fairly good wages in the AJ mine.
So, what did he do in the mine?
Well, he did several things. He was a chute puncher, a chute blaster, which is, one is loading the cars with a crew. He was in charge of the crew that loaded the 10-ton cars. And they divided up into 3 groups. And they had to get out enough trips to make shift worthwhile. They worked 8-hour shifts and came home. And his brother Herbert was the motorman on his crew. In fact, they set a record that was never broken. They made 15 trips of 40-ton cars in an 8-hour shift. He and his crew, two different crews.
What was the hiring situation in the mine?
The mine was pretty good. They had take anybody that they knew could work, and the foremans had a lot to do with who they chose. If my dad wanted a job, he'd just go see one of the foremans that he knew, and then the foreman would tell McLean to hire him. It's that simple, because he knew what he was doing in the mine. So, as a chute blaster, he had to keep the chutes clear without ruining the loading gates, which was pretty expensive material, I guess.
Could you tell me something about the Forest Service officials during that time? Charles Florey, for instance?
I didn't know Charles Florey too well. And I forget the name of the man that came to Sitka to do the hiring for the 3C project. So I can't tell you too much about it. I guess I just blocked it out of my mind because it was a situation that I... In fact, it must have been A and B through someone, because William Paul got a hold of it, and that's how he got started on fighting that discrimination practices in hiring. And so, because Frederick Paul is writing a book, or trying to write a book, and he brings this incident into it, but it doesn't say too much about it. It's just that we were put through the ropes and then told that we couldn't be hired.
What about Frank Heintzelman?
Frank Heintzelman, in the 30s, see, he's the one that became governor too. And, he was good to work for. I worked, as I told you before, I worked in the office, and I did go to work for the 3Cs as timekeeper and typist for foreman, and had to many times type something for Heintzelman, and he always treated me fair because I guess he figured I was a good worker. Well, we had to prove ourselves an awful lot. And there was a non-native boy that was in our painting crew that we were painting what later became the ACS building in Sitka next to the federal building. And then when he couldn't pass, he told me that they wanted me up in the office. I went up there and dictate to his foreman, says, type this for me. So I sat down at the typewriter and typed it out for him and handed it back to him. He says, well, starting tomorrow, you come here and work as timekeeper. That was how I got in. So it was tests, you know, one test after another. We had just had to prove ourselves. Even working for the contractors, we had to prove ourselves. When I quit the ditch gang, as we were called, we worked as a muck stick. I'd finished high school, and here I was still with a muck stick. And I told Ernie Torgerson, who was a foreman, or straw boss, I don't know. Yeah, there's another man over him. He said, I'm quitting as of Friday. So I'm going fishing. He says, I hate to lose you. I says, well, I thought I was the weakest man on your crew. He says, yeah, you might be weak, but you put out more work in 10 hours than all these others. So you work steady. I don't have to watch you. So that's another one that where we proved ourselves. And it's been like that all my life. We just had to prove ourselves all the time.
Were you aware of the Senate hearings that were held here in Juneau in 1936, where this issue of hiring on the CCC came up? Was it?
Vaguely, I heard of it. I think I was in Sitka at the time, so working and, of course, busy in the summer. I might have been fishing that year, and you don't get any news out there. There's no radios on the boats. Mm-hmm. So it's like when President Harding died, we were in Chatham. The only reason we found out is the superintendent got a telegram through their own radio outfit that they had. You know, they had what they call Morse code type. And that's how they found out.
Could you tell me something about your knowledge of the Native CCC projects that started after 1936?
Well, I can tell you about the ones in, excuse me, the ones in Sitka. They had to build the Forest Service decided to put a picnic grounds out at Halibut Point. And they had a crew under Mark Jacobs Sr. working out there with axes and adzes. And everything they build is out of the forest. They build a bridge with it. They build cabins and not cabins, but shelters through that whole picnic area. And all of that was handwork. And another crew under Ralph Young Sr. put that seawall in between the coal storage and the federal building. And that was all handwork. The only ones that were non-natives were the truck drivers, except when I'd get on the truck and drive just to get out of the office for a while. And we brought the rocks and the gravel. And so I learned to dump gravel, which was what I did mostly. The other fellows got the rocks and loaded it onto trucks and they'd bring it in. And that was quite a wall if you look at it. There is no steel, no cement anywhere except in the one in the middle where they build an anchor for a float that they were going to put in there. I don't know if they ever did, but that's the only place you'll find a small bit of concrete and steel. And the rest is all rocks moved by hand into position, and the face of that wall is fairly smooth, except for, you know, where the rocks fit into each other. There's nothing holding it but gravel. And there's a crew under Harold Bailey and George Benson out at the park that recarved the poles that were in bad shape. And even those poles are now deteriorating pretty fast. And they did a lot of work. All these fellas got the leader's pay, which the rest of us were getting. I got the assistant leader's pay, which $6 more than a regular fellas are getting paid.
So you worked as a truck driver?
I worked my job was timekeeper and clerk typist in the office. But there was times when I didn't have a thing to do and I had to go out and get the extra truck or have the foreman take me and get a truck and haul gravel. And I taught some of the other fellows how to drive trucks too, like Louis Minard, and Nick Askan was no problem teaching him how to drive. And he was naturally, he just got in the car and took off and he could shift without any trouble. And taught him how to downshift. So those fellows were really cagey about, because we were losing a lot of drivers, and so they had to do something about it. So that's how I ended up teaching them.
Where did you learn how to drive?
Here in Juneau. I drove, my uncle Edward Coons taught me how to drive a regular car. And from there on, I went in Sitka, and I used to watch the old man that drove a truck in Sheldon Jackson. Watched how he did it, so there's no problem knowing the shifting and everything. I just got used to it. And
let me ask you, how important do you think that was that Native men started working on the CCC projects in 1936?
Well, it's important to the fact that they had to do something to eat, you know, that the hunting seasons were short and we weren't allowed to go out after seasons. We didn't realize that we had many rights that we could have exercised in those days, but we didn't. We tried to stick to the law. And so we followed the, and those that did get caught hunting out of the season usually ended up in jail, losing their rifles. And those that used their boats to fish out of season lost their boats and nets and everything else. So it wasn't an easy life. We had to be careful all the time. And I know of incidents where non-natives with boats would go up inside the no fishing line and they'd be in cahoots with some of the fish and game people, fish and wildlife people in those days. So they would go and find the fish for their one was actually brothers that did that. One worked for the fish and wildlife and his brother was a skipper. And this Dick Richard Tate, who I worked for in the Forest Service, he used to call his brother the biggest fish pirate that ever lived. He says, if I had my way, I'd have him in jail. Was his own brother. So CCC forced us. I mean, we had to do something to earn a living. And that was one way of doing it.
I'm going to turn the tape over mm-hmm. here. It's just about... You mentioned Mr. Yaw
mm-hmm.
at Sheldon Jackson.
Yes.
In some of the research, I noticed that he was quite active in promoting Native hire.
In fact, I think he was the one that talked Andrew Hope into running for the city council in Sitka. Was his first venture into politics. And of course, later on, Andrew went on to be a legislator. True, Mr. Yaw was a very helpful to us as a person in getting things. He allowed us to go from the school to the conventions that were held in as delegates from Sheldon Jackson's junior A and B, and he always allowed us to do that. And he always found work for us in order to get through school. Like I was pretty badly crippled in my second year with arthritis in Sheldon Jackson. But he hired me to do the early morning and late evening firing on the boilers. So that I got through school, paid my sister's way through school at the same time for that year. That's how helpful Mr. Yaw was, and that's just one of the little things that he did for people.
Do you know anything more about him, where he came from?
I think he came from the Middle States. I'm not exactly sure. But he has a book out that may give that. And he's somewhat 50 years or so in Alaska. And he still follows the Alaska Native Brotherhood's way of doing things. In fact, he may be an honorary member of the Alaska Native Brotherhood in Sitka.
Oh, he's still alive?
Yes.
Must be getting along.
You know, he remarried too. His wife, Carolyn, has passed away several years ago. There was a beautiful person.
Well, can you tell me any of the other people who worked on the crew in Sitka or elsewhere that who could tell me something more about the CCC? People are still alive.
There's hardly anybody still alive, because Nick Peters is one of the adsmen and axemen. And, of course, Mark Jacobs, he's gone. He was a foreman. And Nick Cascan drowned in Kodiak, became one of the truck drivers. And Ralph Young and George Benson, who they're all gone now. And Harold Bailey's gone. He was a carver, too, with George Benson. I used to get a kick out of George Benson and Harold Bailey working side by side. One was left-handed and the other was right-handed. So they didn't get in each other's way. But they did beautiful work, you know, copying the poles. And Nick Peters and his crew, I forget who was all in his crew that did, they took two-seater logs and joined them together to make that one great big pole that stands in the center of above the building now in the park. And that was what they used to make that great big pole. Originally it was one log, but they couldn't get one like that again, so they joined two together. And you can't see where it's joined and everything. They did such perfect work, just with acts and ads. And Harold Bailey, of course, would stop and talk to me when I go down, take the time with the men that were there, and show me how to use an ads. He says, it's all in the wrist. I'd try it, and he said, no, and then show me again. Well, I got stories and things from men that were out there and understood the reasoning behind the totem poles and what they stood for, contrary to what the first missionaries thought, that they were idols that we worshipped.
Could you say something about that, the CCC work as a stage in renewing that art of totem building?
I think it did. I think it helped an awful lot, because it showed pride in these men that I mentioned, like Benson and Bailey and a few others that I don't remember their names now. But they're all gone, but it showed pride in their work. And that's why they did such a good job. And, you know, and that they kept it on. I know Benson's livelihood for later years was carving small totems and for sale, which they never got paid enough for, but that's what kept them going after the 3C folded. So, in fact, George Benson was Andrew Hope's brother-in-law, married to Andrew Hope's sister. And Harold Bailey is Robert Loescher's grandfather, who's here with the CLSC.
Are there some, was this tradition carried directly on by the people who are doing carving nowadays?
Now it's still being carried on. It's like Louis Minard, who is one of the fellows I taught to drive a truck, who scared the life out of me. He's carving silver now for up there at the whatever they call the center up there at the park. It's under, is it land management? No.
The National Park
Service. National Park Service, yeah. So, of course, Esther Littlefield has left there now. She's retired from there. But the work they did for the 3Cs, they didn't get much money for, but they showed a lot of pride in their work. And you can see that, because I think every pole in the park was recarved, as well done as the originals.
Is there anything that you would ask if you were in my position that I haven't thought of? I mean, we're going back 50 years here,
yeah.
And it's difficult to recreate the atmosphere and the times. But is there something that you think is important about those days?
We covered
yourself, the CCC, or the Depression that I haven't asked.
We covered the A and B work in all of this, and A and B never stopped. They kept on fighting this discrimination in hiring practices, and they also brought in fairer compensation for work done in the canneries. And they almost formed a union at one time, but discovered that would be unlawful for us to do, so we had to drop it. And A&B has been the one organization that kept the fight up. Other than that, I don't think there's anything more.
What do you think, for instance, about the fact that when they did start hiring Alaska Natives for the CCC, they put them in separate camps, and they had separate Native crews working on some projects and white crews on other projects?
Well, only when I know about is the one in Sitka, and they were not separated. The only difference was that the mechanic at the shop was white, and several of the truck drivers were white. Other than that, they all worked together.
Oh, they weren't entirely separate?
No, no. The only separateness was that one worked at Talbot Point, one worked at in town by the coal storage, and the other worked at the National Monument with the totem poles. But everybody else, I had to keep track of the white crew's time as well as the, and then I had to go up there and take inventory at the shop every once in a while on oil and stuff.
Okay, well, for instance, the crew that worked at Halibut Point, mm-hmm. they built picnic areas and recreation facilities mm-hmm. out there. So was that a mixed crew? Were there white men and Indians both in the crew?
No, for some reason the Indians did it all, but I never saw any white person coming to look for a job. For some reason they felt, I guess it was an all-native project, so except for a few, like the truck drivers that came. Other than that, the truck drivers took them to and from work and hauled stuff that they needed. So other than that.
Well, there were white crews working on other projects around Sitka, though.
Well, I had no knowledge of them. It must have been somewhere else.
Up on the Mount Verstovia Trail?
And that was done during the time that we got turned down. That was before the Native crews, yeah. So that was done with that first group of youngsters that got in. That's the time that the natives took over, did the work. They had specific jobs for them to do. The only time we ever took anybody out was when they had to check out something on the Blue Lake Trail. And Nick Peters took a crew up there of six men. I don't know what they had to do. But all I did was keep their time. It only took one day that they were done. And that's quite a hike up there to Blue Lake from Sawmill Creek. Yeah, that's at the end in Silver Bay. I scared the life out of Nick. Excuse me. He was in a hurry to get out there. He had to get up to Blue Lake and back again before 4:30, I guess it was. He used to have a half hour for luncheon. So he says, "You'll be out here to pick us up on time." I says, "But don't go back as fast as you came out." I says, "You were in a hurry." So he was my cousin, so no problem there. My aunt was his mother.
So that was a native crew then?
Yeah, strictly. Mm-hmm.
See, the reason I ask is that I've talked to some two men over in Sitka who worked on crews. One was at Silver Lake, and mm-hmm. They were not native crews.
Yeah, that was that first crew, because like I said, I had to keep time for everybody, mm-hmm. and there was no white crews other than the ones that were working with us, and they were hauling rocks and working with Ralph Young's crew mostly. And he was telling them what to do because he was their leader. That group that you're talking about, I think, are the ones that came when we first.
It was earlier.
Yeah, earlier, 30, yeah.
33, mm-hmm. 34.
Yeah.
35.
Because when we started, I was 39 when I got into it. Mm-hmm. And of course, in Cake, they build a dam and they tried to build a breakwater, but the rock wasn't the right type, and one person died on that rock fill. And William Newton, who somehow or another got behind the truck instead of in the side of it, and knocked him into the water and he drowned. And other than those two projects, I know that was strictly Indians too. Timekeeper and all. Tommy Jackson could tell you a lot more about that project in Cake. And that dam was quite a feat for Indians. Because that's no greater feat than moving a building from Treadwell to Juneau for the A&B Hall in 1922. and took tide and handwork, and the combined horsepower in the two boats that towed the building over on two barges is 30 and I think it was 20, approximately 50 horsepower
in two boats. Was that the old wooden building that was just torn down here this year or last year?
No, that's just way before.
Way before.
It was rebuilt and made bigger, and then the army came in. They needed the area for during the war for deep depot, so they tore that down afterwards. Became the Channel Apartments.
Mm-hmm. Anything else that you mentioned?
Unless we can think of something later.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, we might want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you very much.
You're quite welcome.
Ron, I'll turn it off now.